Move on to the next case, which is Gray versus Bright, really. Mr. Chayton?
May it please the court. Lewis Chayton, Jones Day, on behalf of Marcus Gray. This case comes to the court from a ruling of the Northern District of Illinois dismissing Marcus Gray's petition for a writ of habeas corpus. The district court determined that Gray failed to comply with a federal statute of limitations for filing such a petition. This court issued a certificate of appealability and appointed counsel to address two main issues. First, whether Gray's petition states a valid claim for the denial of a constitutional right, therefore complies with the requirements for the issuance of a certificate of appealability. Second, whether the district court erred in not tolling the federal statute of limitations during the time during which Gray's state court petition was pending in the Illinois courts. I'll address each of these issues in turn. First, the state wants to make this case a case about interpreting the meaning of Section 2253C of AEDPA, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which requires a substantial showing of a denial of a constitutional right before issuance of a certificate of appealability. And they question the meaning of substantial showing, but we submit that the law here is settled. That is the very issue the U.S. Supreme Court addressed in Slack v. McDaniel, in the very same context, the context where a petition is dismissed on a procedural ground before ever reaching the merits of the petition in the federal district court. And the Supreme Court said this about what sort of showing is a substantial showing in this context. It said it requires a court to take a look at the petition to ascertain whether jurists of reason would find it debatable whether the petition states a valid claim of the denial of constitutional right. And this court's decision in Jefferson v. Wellborn confirms this quick look facial approach.
Does that mean that it just has to state ineffective assistance of counsel, or does it have to recite more than that?
Well, I think it's fair to say it has to recite more than that, and here we have a case with a very diligent petitioner who set forth the basis for his constitutional claim with a great deal of particularity. And in our brief, we reference in particular his claim for ineffective assistance of counsel under the Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and we identify the governing standard, which of course is the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Strickland v. Washington, and moreover, we identify the particular facts supporting that claim. And in particular, Gray alleges that his counsel failed to challenge his unlawful arrest. He was a juvenile at the time, and the arrest was in violation of various state laws, and that the failure to challenge that arrest was ineffective assistance, and that Gray details the fruits of that arrest and explains how his counsel failed to challenge the admission of the fruits of that arrest. The important point here is that neither Slack nor Jefferson require more, and the state has not joined the issue. The state does not mention any of Gray's particular factual allegations in their brief. They simply ask for clarification about what it means to make a substantial showing. We submit they forfeited this argument that there's no reason to reopen what it is to make a substantial showing in this context, that Slack settled that issue. I think the court understands our position on this point, and
But I have one question for you,
sure.
Which is, in a situation such as Slack versus McDaniel contemplates, when somebody like you receives a briefing order where there's a threshold procedural issue under the habeas regime that needs to be resolved, and then we need this showing of a substantial constitutional claim underneath it, if we were to agree with you on the tolling issue, is Mr. Gray now limited to the points that you have raised as to the substantial constitutional showing? Would he need to seek a new certificate of appealability on other issues other than this ineffective assistance of counsel point that you're raising?
Well, Your Honor,
the petition is fairly long, right? It kind of throws in a lot of things, as you said.
Oh, it is quite long, and I have to say it's sort of ironic that the state's complaint here is that his petition is too particular. And going back to Judge Mannion's question, this is the opposite of the case where one comes in a petition and states, my Sixth Amendment rights were violated, period, and that's it, and then tries to claim that that's a substantial showing. This is a very particular showing, and the state responds to none of it. Now, we raised his strongest arguments, and perhaps there'd be the issue in this case of whether he was limited to those arguments on remand if the state had come back and addressed those arguments, but they don't. They completely forfeit this issue. Moving on to the statutory question, it's important to keep in mind this obviously involves a federal statute of limitations, and it, in particular, it's the one-year limitations period that EDPA imposes. And the question here is whether this case qualifies for the tolling provided by EDPA. EDPA provides that a properly filed state court petition tolls the federal statute of limitations. And, of course, this makes sense. The point is that while a petition is making its way through the state court, there's little benefit to requiring a petitioner to come in and file his federal petition. In this case, the federal district court ruled that Gray's petition was untimely and declined to toll the limitations period for the time that Gray's petition was pending. And we submitted erred in doing so, and it plainly erred. The issue of what it means for a petition to be properly filed is no mystery. The Supreme Court addressed this very issue in a recent case, Ortiz v. Bennett, and that case says that not all state procedural bars, even if you could find a state procedural bar in the opinion of the last state court to address the petition, that not all state procedural defaults make a petition not properly filed. And that it depends on whether the state bar at issue is a precondition to filing, in which case it would not be properly filed, or a precondition to relief, in which case it would be properly filed. And we submit that this issue was settled in this circuit in Rice v. Bowen, this court's decision in Rice v. Bowen, where the court addressed the very statute that the state is raising here, the Illinois timing statute, and held that because of the way that statute operates, a post-conviction petition that's ultimately found to be untimely is nevertheless properly filed.
Have you looked at a case that's very recent, United States versus Walls?
Yes. That was decided a few weeks ago, and I think that's very significant for this case because it strongly bolsters the rationale in Rice v. Bowen, and Smith v. Walls, of course, dealt with the Illinois restriction on second or successive petitions. And if you read that case together with Tinker v. Hanks, which dealt with the Indiana restriction on second or successive petitions, I think it very strongly bolsters Rice v. Bowen's reasoning. And Tinker v. Hanks holds that failure to comply with the Indiana requirement makes a petition not properly filed. And the reason is that Indiana requires the petitioner to get leave of the court before filing a second or successive petition. And the court in Smith v. Walls says that Illinois also envisages that a petitioner will only file one petition. But in Illinois, the petitioner can go ahead and file that second or successive petition, and the petitioner must show that the first proceeding was infected with some sort of fundamental unfairness. And of course, that's going to be a very rare thing. It's a very difficult procedural hurdle to overcome. But nevertheless, because the statute instructs a petitioner that though a second or successive petition is barred, to go ahead and file it, and the state may have very good defenses to it, but the filing is accepted by the court and entered into the docket, and it's therefore properly filed under Ortiz v. Bennett's rationale. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
That's fine. Ms. Fleming.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Mary Fleming, Assistant Attorney General. Your Honors, in this case, the District Court properly dismissed petitioner's federal habeas corpus petition because his state post-conviction petition was untimely and did not toll the AEDPA's statute of limitations. Petitioner disregards, in his reply, this court's recognition that untimeliness is a procedural bar and that this court has applied Harris v. Reed to questions regarding timeliness under Section 2244D.
But if somebody were to file a complaint in a district court, you know, there are statutes of limitations, of course, that apply to such and to most, almost every case. The district court doesn't reject the filing because it might be late. Indeed, the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense under Rule 8, if it were a civil case, that has to be pleaded before it can be entertained. And that's one problem I have with the state's theory here, since Ortiz is trying to draw this distinction between filing preconditions, such as we have for second and successive petitions, such as Indiana has, and merits determinations. There are a host of procedural bars that might yield a certain decision on the merits. So I'm not sure it's enough just to call it procedural to get as far as you need to go.
Your Honor, respondent would submit that both the language of the statute and Illinois case law do not require a court to do a merits determination as to timeliness, and that timeliness, that issue, is not a condition to relief. It's a
But what do you mean by a merits determination? Even counting up the time, much less figuring out whether there's excusable neglect, which exists in the Indiana statute, I mean in the Illinois statute, both require a post-filing evaluation. It's the kind of thing that the state could waive, for example. The state doesn't have to plead timeliness if it doesn't want to. States do waive those things sometimes.
But, Your Honor, in Illinois, the court is permitted in the first stage of non-capital cases to sua sponte dismiss on untimeliness.
Is it required to? Is it like a jurisdictional bar, or is it simply permitted to?
It's not required to do so, but it's permitted to not exercise jurisdiction in that case. And this is similar to what in Ortiz, an example the court used in drawing a distinction between petitions that are pending and petitions that are properly filed. Two of the examples they used are when a clerk accepts a petition that doesn't have the required filing fee, and when a clerk accepts a petition in which the court will not have jurisdiction.
But do they file them in that case? I thought they just put a received on them. They don't really file them, do they?
Well, the court in Ortiz talks about them either in terms of being filed or being pending, but not technically properly filed. And in Illinois, the court could still choose to not exercise jurisdiction.
But that's a dismissal. I mean, that's a merits determination. It's a determination that a precondition to relief, namely timeliness of filing, hasn't happened. And perhaps another analogy is people who are seeking to proceed IFP. They'll come to the court and say, I would like to proceed IFP. I would like my case to be filed. But the case isn't filed until the IFP proceedings are concluded. The court decides, yes, you can. This isn't frivolous. It's not barred for any reason. So it's not even filed in until some preliminary things have happened. But I don't think that's the case that we have here.
Well,
the structure Illinois has chosen to create.
Your Honor, in this case, when a court is looking at whether there's a lack of culpable negligence attendant to an untimely petition, the court's looking at the circumstances surrounding why the petitioner filed late. It has absolutely nothing to do with the merits of the claim. They're just looking at the circumstances surrounding the claim.
And neither does someone's indigence, right? I mean, there are things a sanctions petition also wouldn't have anything to do with the merits of the claim. The question is, does the court do that after it's been filed and say, you're late because you haven't demonstrated excusable, you know, reasons, or does the court do it pre-filing?
Your Honor, I think the important question would be whether the answer to that would be it's done before the petition is properly filed. And that's what the court keeps looking at in Ortiz v. Bennett, whether the petition was properly filed. This is an example, just like the examples given in Ortiz. And also, part of the court's consideration in Ortiz was if we're looking at whether claims are waived or not, we're going to have some claims that are procedurally defaulted and some that aren't. We're not going to have those concerns in this kind of a case with a timeliness issue. The entire petition is either untimely or it's not untimely.
But, you know, there's another thing that troubles me about the state's position. I thought the idea behind O'Sullivan against Burkle was that if the state affords an avenue for somebody to obtain relief in the state courts, even if it's a discretionary avenue, which certainly appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court is, and this excusable neglect, or whatever it's called, provision is, nonetheless, you have to try it first before you can get into federal court, because we don't want people bypassing the state court system for a whole series of reasons that are good reasons. So it seems to me to penalize somebody who does try the state avenue is at least philosophically inconsistent with O'Sullivan, if not on the exact same point.
Well, Your Honor, a petitioner does have to try to go through the right avenue, but he has to try within the correct time limits. And this court in Freeman spoke to the very similar issue, saying if you have a question, what you need to do, petitioner, is come to federal court.
And but, you know, what you're not talking about is Rice against Bowen, which perhaps you don't want to talk about, but it
no,
is right now out there. I realize the petition for cert is pending in it, but
and
for
I
the
have,
time being.
I would also ask you about the United States versus Walls. Are you familiar with that case?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Does that apply here?
Your Honor, the Walls case is completely different factually, first of all, because there's no question of timeliness in that case. And there is not, as in this case, a clear finding of untimeliness. And actually, a respondent in that case also would assert that the question of whether the first proceedings were fundamentally unfair is a threshold that the petitioner has to get by before his petition could be properly filed and before a trial court would choose to exercise jurisdiction in that case. And as to Rice, Your Honor,
well, I just want to just quote, I just as an example, it says that, as with the New York statutes in R2, successive petitions in Illinois that fail to satisfy these conditions to relief will not be successful, but they have been properly delivered and accepted so long as the filing conditions have been met. It just seems that it addresses this issue pretty directly. I realize the state has a petition for rehearing on this.
Your Honor, the court's saying in that case, I believe, that the petition is properly filed because, as the court said, it believed that the circuit court would be looking to whether the claims brought forth in the second petition were raised in the first petition. And that's very similar to what the court's talking about in our petition. But that's definitely not the situation here, where we have a court saying that this, an appellate court, the last court to look at it, to clearly and expressly and unambiguously say, this petition was untimely. It's just completely different, actually. And as to Rice, Your Honor, I would say that also it is completely different, actually, because this court said in Rice there was no clear and express finding of untimeliness. It wasn't clear what the court relied on in that case. The court did a merits analysis and then an alternative timeliness.
So even if it's filed and accepted, if timeliness is the reason it is, I guess, dismissed or rejected, then that would not be, in your opinion, properly filed.
Exactly, Your Honor. Otherwise, we would have a conflict between Harris and Rice. Harris, which allows us to rely on a finding of untimeliness in this kind of case. And, Your Honor, I'd like to address petitioner's argument as to the slack issue in this case. Respondent is definitely not defaulting as to the four issues that petitioner has raised in his brief, but respondent is in the difficult position of not having a full record before it and being able to fully brief out these issues. And it's not even completely clear. Petitioner seems to be limiting himself to those four issues, but whether he would try to argue the other 13 issues that petitioner raised in his petition as well. We know that this court is bound by slack to do something with the constitutional claims to get to the procedural issues, but it puts respondent in a difficult position. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, we respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's order. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Caton, you've got 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple points. One, the state mentions the conflict between Harris v. Reed and Rice, and we submit that that is not a conflict. Harris v. Reed provides a rule for determining whether there was any sort of procedural default at a state level, and Rice and Ortiz and the rationale set forth in those cases are outline what sorts of procedural defaults are preconditions to filings and which sorts are preconditions to relief for purposes of the federal statute of limitations. The other thing I would like to address real quick is the state's argument that culpable negligence has nothing to do with the merits of the petition, and that's just plain wrong, because the Illinois Supreme Court in People v. Caballero said that one of the things the culpable negligence contemplates is that if a petitioner has a claim, the predicate facts for which were not previously available, then failing to file within certain time limitations will not bar that claim under the culpable negligence exception. And that clearly involves looking at the petition and looking at the merits and the substance of what the petitioner is claiming. In conclusion, I'd just like to say that that the court should remand this case with instructions to the district court to accept Gray's petition and to review it on the merits. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks, and we thank you for your fine briefing.